Okay, so we're here on the line with filmmakers and political organizers Chris Vargas and Eric Stanley, talking to them about their films and recent projects.
First, hi.
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 Okay, so our first question is, how did the two of you first connect as filmmakers to make Homotopia and then Criminal Queers?
Well, we met at UC Santa Cruz. I was studying free at UC Santa Cruz in the Film and Digital Media Department, and Eric Stanley was my TA for a class called Film, Video, and Gender. And I was, sorry, cut you off.
I was going to say it's true, and Chris, for his final project, made a really amazing embroidery of Michael Jackson's mugshot that awarded him an A+ in that class.
I think it was my only A+. Thank you, Eric. Yeah. We made Homotopia, actually. I was doing a production class, and the final project was a 12-minute movie, and actually Homotopia first debuted as a 12-minute project for that class, and it grew up to double its size.
What inspired you both to make Homotopia?
At the time that we filmed it, which was 2006, is that right? Mm-hmm. It was kind of at the height of the gay marriage frenzy here in California, and there was a lot of documentaries coming out in support of gay marriage without any critique or questioning of the institution of marriage or the, you know, there's no referencing the historical feminist critiques of the institution of marriage. And so we really wanted to kind of create some space for people to think more critically about what this politic would actually look like. And we also wanted to, you know, use visual culture as a way to open up conversations that might be shut down by other forms of, you know, intervention, whether they be like a, you know, writing or something like that.
Mm-hmm. We also, we were coming off of the big hoopla around Brokeback Mountain. So it was this huge time where people were really optimistic about gay representation in mainstream Hollywood movies. And we were kind of incredulous about people's like love for this movie. And it was, so clearly like a straight made movie about gay people for straight audiences. And we were wondering, we were excited about, you know, making gay movies for gay audiences, thinking about that.
Which sadly has become a novel idea these days.
So what inspired you to make Criminal Queers after Homotopia?
Well, we toured Homotopia around a lot and had a lot of conversations and people. And one of the biggest questions after watching Homotopia was like, well, if you don't think that the marriage rights movement is a worthwhile cause, what would be a worthwhile cause in your opinion? And we didn't really want to, we were reluctant to kind of be prescriptive and offer people answers about what to do or what causes they should get behind. But sort of an easy thing to do, and it was something that was important to us. So we offered up prison abolition as one possible option outside of marriage rights activism.
We'd also, during the same time period, we have been making Criminal Queers over the last 4 years. Chris and I were both involved in CR10, which was Critical Resistance's 10-year anniversary conference. Mm-hmm. And we also were involved in TGIJP, Transgender Intersex Justice Project, helped put on a conference called Transforming Justice, which was about 3 years ago. And so we were both kind of doing a lot of this organizing and thinking a lot about prison abolition and what that would mean if we took a kind of radical trans and queer take on prison abolition.
So what was the creative process of writing, directing, and filming like?
Well, it's a pretty loose process. We often don't work with scripts, and we sort of know what the story is going to do, but we offer a lot of room to our actors to either write or develop their characters within kind of loose but specific parameters about what they're going to do or what the story is going to end up doing or where it's going to lead. So it's a very loose script. A lot of our actors, kind of the character actor parts, the smaller parts, are written by the actors themselves. In the case of Matilda, Bernstein, Sycamore, and Greg Yeomans, and yeah, so they like took on creating this character and giving lines and giving lines to those characters.
I think also something that's important about our filming process, which is really different, you know, with the kind of frenzy around Kickstarter and all those kinds of things. We made both of these films with no budget, and for real no budget, meaning, you know, I mean, we've spent money on it, but the majority of the money that we've spent, we have spent on food. And that was, you know, a product of necessity, and also we had a commitment to trying to figure this out without thinking that first we needed to fundraise $100,000 before we could make a movie. Mm-hmm. And this comes from a long line of, you know, feminist filmmakers having very little resources and just, you know, doing what they could do with their friends. And so a lot of friends and lovers and exes and all kinds of people have donated their time and their energy and their skills to make these movies come to life.
So how did you negotiate shooting a lot of the film in a lot of diverse locations?
Well, we don't often ask permission for these locations. And usually we've been pretty lucky just showing up and setting up our camera and taking the shots that we need and then leaving really quick. But the ironic thing about guerrilla shooting is the places that you imagine are going to be the easiest are often not. So, one story we had was we were shooting in the bathroom of a UC Berkeley building, and this is a campus, this is a school I go to, and I was just barely a student at the time, but I had an ID, so I thought I was legit, but the people in the building didn't agree with that, so we got tossed out, and they were made to feel very sketchy or sketched out by us, because I don't know, they probably thought we were shooting some sort of film in the or porn movie in the bathroom, but we weren't. The Alcatraz was also easy, so yeah, like you'd imagine you'd need a ton of permission to go to Alcatraz and put your friend in a prison jumpsuit, but it was like living history, so all the tourists were really excited about that.
Yeah, we also kind of have this defense that we try to use whenever someone asks us something, we just pretend like we're doing a student film, and saying the word student film and acting as if you're really naive can buy you a lot of time often to just get out of the situation.
Which is how we got the HRC location, which is Eric's favorite story to tell. You want to tell it?
Sure. So something may or may not happen in the HRC, the Human Rights Campaign. We can't give away what happened. But anyway, a part of the film was shot in there. And how we procured that location is we knew that the HRC probably was not going to be very interested in our project, as part of our project is dismantling the HRC. And so we went to them and we asked if we could, or how we might go about shooting inside the store. And the manager of the store said that we didn't have a very good chance, but we could write a proposal and they would send it to their corporate headquarters in Washington, D.C., and their lawyers would go over it. So we wrote a really ridiculous, incredibly earnest treatment for a fake film that we never made called Girlfriends, about a drag queen's first night out on the town in which she was going to go shopping with her friends at her favorite store, which was the HRC. And it was so ridiculous that they saw no threat in it and officially allowed us to shoot inside. We've not been sued yet by them, but I'm sure that will be coming soon.
It's going to be the best PR we've ever gotten.
We really need to find that treatment for Girlfriends and make it into a movie.
I know, just so if they try to sue us, we could say, we made that. Just we'll use the Susan and Joy footage and somehow cut it into that story. Just in case.
That's a really good story.
Yeah, see? Naivety will get you a long way.
One day we're going to age out of that excuse that we're students.
I know, we're just going to look really... it's not going to be pretty.
I guess we're returning. We're lifelong students.
I know.
What was it like to work with so many amazing people in a project dedicated to challenging the ways queers participate in systems of violence?
That's a good question. I mean, I think for me, the more and more as time goes on, the film becomes incredibly strangely autobiographical, because it's kind of like at the same time that we're, you know, producing a film and it has politics behind it, it also becomes this interesting scrapbook of mine and Chris's life over the last, you know, four, and counting Homotopia, now like 6 years or something like that. And just about everyone in the film, you know, we have like real life interactions with and we organize with. And so it's kind of an extension of that. There aren't really any quote unquote, you know, professional actors. There might be one or two, which were also friends or connections that we had. And so, I mean, it's been a really amazing and sometimes trying process. You know, working with friends is great, but can also be a little tricky when you're trying to, you know, get them out of the bed and they don't want to get out of the bed and they don't want to wake up or, you know, say their lines or whatever.
Yeah, it's fun and challenging. I don't know what I would add to that. It is a document. It's so wonderful to see even now. Like, it's taken so long for us to complete the movie, but seeing some of the stuff we shot in like the early years, the first year, is so sweet to me. I feel so sentimental. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like we made this like awesome, beautiful document of this moment of our lives, and also like where the conversation around queer and trans prison abolition is the moment. So it's personal, and I hope we made something that can appeal to a lot of different people. Not Hollywood, though.
You don't think they're coming knocking in?
I'm not going to answer if they do.
The film is really campy. So why did you sort of decide to make it campy, and what does camp mean to you in the context of both the films?
Well, camp humor is something that I was always drawn to as a young queer person. Those are the kind of queer images that I was most drawn to. And while, you know, tons of camp is problematic and misogynist and weird and, you know, troubling, there's something that is still disarming and wonderful about it. And part of the project of Criminal Queers is to have a different conversation around prison abolition. And there's tons of, you know, straightforward talking head documentaries out there on various subjects, even prison abolition. But to make something humorous and sort of fun and pleasurable to watch, something important to us, you know, I think it appeals to people who might be turned off by some, you know, more dry, more factual, straightforward documentary style film.
How do you see your role as filmmakers in relation to the political organizing that you do in queer communities?
I mean, I guess for me, kind of my organizing work, my academic work, or my artistic, broadly explained work, are all kind of just different methods for articulating similar and related politics. I mean, I think, you know, it's exciting and important to think about as many different, you know, modes of delivery as we can to kind of complicate our conversations and our ways of understanding things. And so for me, it's kind of just another extension. It might, you know, it's related to, you know, organizing direct action or writing a dissertation or whatever else, you know, we might be doing.
Yeah, it works as a nice supplement. I don't think the movie itself is going to, you know, blow down any prison walls, but it certainly can add to larger movement and conversation that might.
So both Homotopia and Criminal Queers do a lot of work to disrupt and challenge the way, all the different ways that queer people can participate in or collude with state violence and systemic violence. So throughout your travels in screening both the films, how have you seen the politics of the films received and taken up in like ways that you thought were really cool or really rad by local like queer and trans communities?
I think that the way that the films have been received so far, we haven't shown Criminal Queers all that often yet, but the way they've actually been received fairly differently, I think, in my experience. And Homotopia, you know, we showed it right after we made it pretty quickly and then started touring it, and it was still, I think that the kind of, at least within the States, the political climate has changed somewhat around the question of gay marriage, but at the time it was kind of the only question. And so we were met with really oftentimes hostile responses mm-hmm. to it. People were really angry, you know, because the way the conversation was manufactured was that, you know, you could either be anti-gay marriage, homophobic person, or if you were gay, you were automatically understood as someone that was kind of unquestionably supporting gay marriage. And here we were, two radical queer-identified people that were questioning the institution of gay marriage. And so that got a lot of people really upset. And we got lots of arguments, lots of shouting, lots of things.
Yeah, it was great. I didn't say anything, but I will add, it was really awesome to see that conversation change from hostile to pretty open. I think, I don't know if that little film did, you know, changed the whole conversation, the whole national conversation, people's skepticism about the right to marriage movement. But it's been great to be able to see that, you know, people are more open to critiquing that as, you know, the issue of gay politics. I feel, I don't know, proud maybe that I could have done a little bit towards that.
And I think that, I'm not sure. I mean, I feel like, I don't know how you feel about this, Chris, but the, I don't know, because people don't respond with the same kind of antagonism around our abolitionist politics. So I don't know if conversations around abolition are in a different place, or people are not exactly understanding what we're saying, or what.
Or we've just gotten really savvy in our delivery, and people don't want to argue with us, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Because maybe, you know, as amateurs, like, you know, touring around, first time, you know, touring with a movie, like, people sort of could smell our fear and insecurity, so they just jumped on it. I don't know. I have no idea.
I mean, something else that's exciting, at least to me, about Criminal Queers is, you know, we're primarily brought to schools or wherever we're brought to by, you know, the queer clubs or the gay clubs, and those are oftentimes not spaces that prison abolition or even prison issues are really discussed. And so, you know, we might come to a campus and it's, you know, the one gay event of the year, and so all the queer people come out, and, you know, instead of getting a kind of watered down coming out narrative, whatever, they might usually get programmed with, or a Dan Savage or whoever, they get us. And so, you know, we get to kind of help form those conversations, which is exciting.
What are some of the ways you see radical queer organizing continuing to participate in and collude with state violence?
I guess for me, I would have to narrow down the discussion and, you know, try to figure out the ways, like, my question would be, like, for you, like, what kind of radical queer organizing, or, I don't know. Do you mean just generally? I mean, I think, like, in terms of the ways that radical queer organizing oftentimes gets figured or gets written into history, I mean, you know, it reproduces a lot of the same issues around, you know, white supremacy and issues of class. I mean, as a kind of rubric that people oftentimes get placed in or, you know, identify within, it's still the most visible forms of radical queer organizing oftentimes still have a certain kind of, you know, college educated or, you know, college participating in middle class whiteness about them. But I also think that it depends on what, you know, what we're constituting radical queer organizing, because for me, there's a whole kind of lineage of radical queer organizing that is definitely not that. And they might themselves not even necessarily identify as radical queers, but I definitely think that that lineage is there as well. And, you know, there's no such thing about none of us are outside forms of state or other kinds of violence. And so we all kind of participate in them one way or another. It's just how we're going to respond to that participation and how we're going to attempt to at least provisionally kind of stall forms of violence or transform forms of violence. I think that that's the question.
Well said, Eric.
Well said. Yeah. Teacher lady.
Could you maybe speak a little bit more about sort of what you just like touched on there, the types of organizing that like are really radical and but don't necessarily get represented as that or aren't talked about in like those kinds of ways?
I think, for example, TGIJP, Transgender Gender Variant Intersex Justice Project, which is a group here in San Francisco, which is kind of headed up by Miss Major. They do really amazing stuff around, specifically around trans women of color in reentry after coming out of prison, or just kind of basic political education work that is really amazing. And Miss Major's analysis is definitely, you know, among the most radical that I know. She oftentimes doesn't get read in radical queer history or like understood through that lens, but that's a kind of space of organizing that I find, you know, really inspiring.
Eric, we're wondering if we could talk to you for a second. We were wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your new book, Captive Genders.
Sure. Captive Genders is an anthology that I edited along with Nat Smith. We have been working on it for about the last 6.5-7 years, and it brings together 38, I think, different authors and 21 different pieces. About a third of them are current or former prison people. And what we really wanted to do was create some space for all these conversations that have been happening, all the organizing that has been happening historically and in the contemporary around trans and queer prison issues, and specifically around abolition, right? So we'd have been doing all this thinking, all this organizing, all this work, but we wanted to kind of create an actual space for it to exist in. And so that was the birth of Captive Genders long ago. And it's an anthology, and so it kind of thinks through a bunch of different issues. And we also are invested in thinking about the prison industrial complex in the most broadest sense. So it's not only about trans and queer people that are in prisons, even though that's a really important aspect of the book, but it's also about reimagining the limits of the prison itself. So we have a piece in there about obviously about immigration in the States, and also there's a really interesting piece about SROs, single resident occupancy hotels, which oftentimes function in various ways as prisons. And then another, the other kind of goal of the book is to not only understand how trans people are affected by the PIC, but how the PIC, which is the prison industrial complex, but how the prison industrial complex itself is a gendering apparatus, right? So it's not, so the question then becomes, if we disrupt gender normativity or heteronormativity, that also helps to take down the PIC. And so there's this kind of relationship between the two that helps literally make the materiality of each other.
That sounds amazing. I'm really excited. What was it like working on the book?
It's a very long process. You know, it's like jumping into the deep end of the ocean, and then there's a tidal pull, and then it pulls you away. I should probably get like some nice story about transformation, but that's actually what it's like. You know, it's like it's a lot of ebbs and flows, a lot of, you know, we wanted to support a lot of the voices that are maybe first-time published authors, people that have less experience with writing, so we tried to create ways for people's voices to be included that weren't necessarily, if they didn't necessarily feel comfortable sitting down and writing an essay. So there's things like interviews, there's personal stories, and there's different ways for people to kind of contribute. And we thought those were really important. You know, and a lot of time it's a lot of hurry up and waiting, because people are, you know, in the middle of their lives, oftentimes living through various forms of trauma because of the PIC. And so then having the time, space, you know, the kind of health necessary to sit down and write something or to do an interview, you know, it might take a lot of time. And so a lot of it was, you know, giving people the time and the space to get that done while also feeling really, really dedicated to the thing actually coming out, the book actually coming out. You know, we didn't want it to become one of those amazing projects that disappeared into, you know, the history bin. And so, yeah, it'll come out on August 1st from AK Press, and it will be very exciting.
Cool. Where are you launching the book?
I guess that we're going to do maybe a very mini tour. You know, obviously there's not necessarily a very large market for this kind of book, and because we find the voices in the book to be so important, we want to try to, you know, make sure that it gets out to as many people as possible. And so we'll probably do a little bit of an East Coast tour and maybe go up to Canada, I'm not sure. But we'll have the official book launch in San Francisco in the middle of August, I'm guessing.
Awesome. So, Chris, we were wondering if we could talk to you for a few minutes about your new short film.
Sure.
So we were wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your most recent film.
Which one? The one that, the Liberacion? Well, it is a, it sort of re-scripts the biography of the late pianist Liberace. And rewrites his death from HIV into the catalyst for radical direct action activism around AIDS and HIV, basically the inception of ACT UP. And it pulls from sort of details I found in his biography about his relationship to Ronald Reagan. And apparently he was kind of palsy with him, and as a person who really appreciates Liberace, this is these are kind of details I didn't really want to embrace about him or his character, and I sort of took it upon myself to re-script his intentions around sending this gift to the White House, which is a chocolate piano. And in the chocolate piano, in my story, he sort of uses that as a gesture, a confrontational gesture towards Ronald Reagan about his kind of inaction around the AIDS crisis in the early 80s, or mid to early 80s. I guess it's what I made for my MFA thesis project, and right now it's actually a three-channel video installation, and there's two other monitors alongside the narrative that are candelabras flickering into eternity with little pink triangles in them.
How does your work in Liberation offer a more radical history than, say, the recent blockbuster about the life of San Francisco politician Harvey Milk?
Let's see. I mean, it really embraces a radical queer history, whereas kind of Milk offers something a lot more watered down. And it approaches history as already sort of rewritten for a more liberal politics. So like Milk came right on the brink of, you know, the Prop 8 election, or the Prop 8 hoopla in California, and it was kind of really amazingly timed to where sort of viewers watching Mill could easily associate these two movements, or these two moments in history around the Briggs Initiative and the right to marriage movement, which were pretty different, I think. But Liberacion assumes that Liberace's biography is already going to be, it's already written in a way that puts him in a more conservative if liberal at all, political, like, position, and kind of re-scripts in order to play with that history a little bit.
Why was this an important project for you, and sort of why is Liberace himself an important figure?
Well, personally, I have sort of a sentimental attachment to him and his museum, which was in Las Vegas until very recently. It closed last fall. And I don't know. I mean, it's one of those, he's one of those figures that I was sort of drawn to because of his simultaneous, like, flamboyance while being totally closeted. So I'm drawn to the contradictions about him and his life. And to talk about him in relation to AIDS was really important, in that up to, you know, past his death, I think he had all his staff and his help suppress that information that he was actually HIV positive and that he was dying of AIDS. And it was important in talking. I mean, it's important to talk about AIDS right now because it's just, you know, so rarely talked about. Luckily, I feel like it's coming back into the conversation. Mm-hmm. There was just a big news headline article on our local gay paper, mm-hmm. AIDS at 30. So, I mean, the conversation about AIDS and people living with AIDS and got really kind of pushed to the sidelines with the whole Right to Marry movement in California. And so, yeah, I mean, just to bring it back up and help bring to the fore that this is still a really important conversation and important history to evoke, as well as, you know, current history.
Awesome. Well, thanks for talking to us. We were wondering what's next for you two.
Whew, what's next, Eric?
Well, we should finish Criminal Queers.
We're gonna eat dinner.
Oh, yeah, we're gonna have Ethiopian food in a few hours here. It'll be delicious.
Yeah, finish Criminal Queers and eat dinner. We're too ambitious. Goals for our future.
Yeah, no, definitely finishing Criminal Queers and getting it out far and wide. Obviously, there's not a readily available market for these kinds of films, and so, you know, just getting it out and continuing the conversations that are already happening.
And take a nap.
any music requests?
Eric, do you have any?
Is Katie Lang, is she Canadian?
Katie Lang.
Yes,
is totally
indeed.
Close.
Okay, there we go.
Canadians totally know their own. It's so
that's true. How about some Constant Craving?
Okay, sounds good.
What about you, Chris? Do you have any?
I want to hear the Canadian angel herself, Celine Dion. Any of her work.
I like her earlier work.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Okay. Nice. All right. We'll find an oldie but a goodie. We should chat again soon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we've left y'all with some musical choices.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank bye, you guys.
Bye.
All right. Take care.
Bye.